for that. You know, it's horrifying that Hamas took hostages. It's totally a war crime, right? That should be exposed. But my goodness, you know, with 40,000 people dead, 15,000 children dead, 19,000 children orphaned, 1 million children displaced, for our party to have a Palestinian American speaker to talk about this, I think would be a really positive thing and indicate growth for our party. I think Kamala Harris is going to be our next president. She needs to be. There's no president in this century, two Republicans and two Democrats, who's actually moved the ball forward for peace in the Middle East in a significant way. I need Kamala Harris to be that president who changes that dynamic. I think she can be. We're hoping that she really finds a way to express that in this convention and afterwards. Having a Palestinian speaker in primetime would certainly be a positive thing, and we're still hoping for that.
Mm. And finally, you mentioned billionaires of the other party. We just have 20 seconds. Explain what you mean deciding Democratic primary candidates.
Right. Well, so it's, you know, there's a lot we have to do to get dark money out of politics, right? Citizens United. But it's up to the political parties to set their own rules. So within Democratic primaries, our party, our leaders in the House and Senate could set rules to say, no, if you're running for the U.S. House or U.S. Senate as a Democrat in a Democratic primary, we don't want and we're not going to let Republican billionaire dollars in here. And that would be better for our party.
We're going to have to leave it there. Andy.
KABU Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KABU by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kabu.fm/give. Thank you.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kabu.fm. The August Finance Committee meeting will be held on Thursday, August 22nd at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In...
I don't hear anything. Uh-oh.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, new data show a spike in COVID cases in Oregon.
A committee selects a less popular design for the new Burnside Bridge.
And Northwest tribes face extra challenges when it comes to addressing the impact of climate change on their communities.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, August 21st, 2024. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. COVID has never gone away, but now we likely all know someone who recently came down with the disease. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority said COVID infection rates have ticked up since late May, and they remain elevated. Between July 27th and August 10th, around 16% of people who took a COVID test logged by the state tested positive for an infection. That's a 45% increase over the same period last year, 11%, though the rates did peak around 15% last September. The amount of testing in Oregon has declined significantly since the height of the pandemic, from tens of thousands per week in 2021 to between 1 and 3,000 this April. State health officials are encouraging Oregonians to follow standard COVID mitigation actions, including being up to date on vaccinations, wearing a mask in public gathering places, washing hands frequently, and staying home if they're sick.
A design for the new Burnside Bridge has been selected to replace the current span. The new bridge is designed to survive an earthquake and provide a vital lifeline crossing in the event of a serious Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Last week, the project's Community Design Advisory Group voted for an inverted Y cable stay design. It features a triangular-shaped tower that's connected to the bridge by cables that are attached to a single column. There aren't too many bridges with that particular design, but one is the Bunker Hill Bridge in Boston. Another similar design is under construction in Detroit. Interestingly, the 20,000 Portlanders surveyed ranked the bridge design fourth out of the six options they were presented with. The design will cost $45 million more than some of the others. The bridge redo has federal grant funds and money from the Oregon legislature, but updated construction costs with inflation are expected next spring. The project has been in the works for a long time. It was 2015 when the county decided that the Burnside Bridge would be a critical connection to protect in an event of an earthquake. Construction could start as soon as 2027.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU of Oregon, and its legal partners sue the Medford Police for monitoring the social media accounts of local organizers. The lawsuit alleges that the Medford Police Department monitored and surveyed the social media accounts of individuals and groups that are engaged in causes such as racial justice, LGBTQ plus rights, reproductive justice, housing justice, harm reduction, decriminalization. There are also concerns that the police collected and maintained information and files on them when they were not suspected of any criminal activity. The plaintiffs, those being monitored, are the mutual aid and educational group Rogue Valley Pepper Shakers, harm reduction nonprofit Stab and Wagon, and Melissa Jones, former director of Stab and Wagon. Medford City Attorney Eric Mitten denied that police broke state law because their purpose in surveilling social media wasn't to collect information on political views. Rather, they monitored online activity for potential public safety concerns like traffic disruptions and property damage from rallies and protests. Kelly Simon, legal director of the ACLU of Oregon, said, quote, "These aren't public safety threats. People aren't engaged in crime. But the police are being distracted by useless information and that sort of waste of resources that detracts from real public safety concerns in the community," end quote.
Food banks are helping to significantly decrease carbon emissions, according to a new report. The Global Food Banking Network's annual impact report finds food banks around the world stopped 1.8 million metric tons of carbon emissions last year by preventing food from going to waste in landfills. The network includes food banks in more than 50 countries. Rachel Lucille with Oregon Food Bank says food waste is the result of food that's both inaccessible and unaffordable.
When we, as in food banks, work with local growers to intercept perfectly good edible food before it's thrown out, that helps to mitigate harmful greenhouse gas emissions created by food waste.
Food waste in landfills is a major source of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that captures heat at a higher rate than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. About 1 in 8 Oregonians faces food insecurity, meaning they aren't sure where their next meal will come from. Carbon emissions from food waste exacerbate climate change, and the impact from there is circular. Lucille says wildfires across Oregon are affecting food production.
Extreme weather events caused by climate change disrupt food supply chains that lead to increased and unpredictable pricing of food, increased risk of food deserts for the communities that are already facing food insecurity, and fewer fresh fruits and vegetables.
One way to fight food waste is through support of small local agriculture, which Lucille says their organization does through its community producer support project. They say small farmers might help fight climate change.
It contributes to biodiversity, uses sustainable farming practices, and keeps food local, which reduces fossil fuel emissions related to packaging and transportation of food.
That was Rachel Lucille with the Oregon Food Bank.
Coastal tribes in the Northwest are on the front lines of the changing climate, but face barriers to responding to its effects. A new report collected testimony directly from tribal members to hear what their biggest hurdles are. Sea level rise is already pushing some tribes from the coast of Washington. Mead Crosby is a senior scientist with the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group, one of the organizations behind the report. She says tribes have been at the forefront of adapting to climate change, but their biggest barriers stem from accessing funds to address the scale of the issue.
The tribes are having to navigate really a maze of different pots of money that are spread out across different agencies and departments and units within federal government agencies. So they're having to chase down these funds.
The report was compiled with input from listening sessions with members from 13 tribal nations on the Washington and Oregon coasts. It identified five key barriers to greater adaptation to climate change, including funding, staffing, and technical expertise. Funds from the Inflation Reduction Act, Congress's 2022 climate action law, could help speed up tribes' responses. The Tribal Coastal Resilience Program, associated with the University of Washington, recently received $3.4 million for coastal readiness projects. Amelia Marchand is with the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians, which also worked on the report.
We're hoping that those funding opportunities will be less of a burden, a little bit more supportive to the flexible and timely needs that tribes have.
But even with the funding, Marchand notes that climate change is accelerating, worsening the conditions for tribes.
Swift action is really needed to ramp up the response and to have it occur in a manner that's coordinated and respectful of tribal sovereignty, tribal self-determination, and tribal rights.
That was Amelia Marchand with the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians.
Former President Obama and Michelle Obama ready Democrats to fight until Election Day. The Harris campaign launches a new social media push to engage Latino voters. And an Indiana delegate says reproductive rights is his county's top issue. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks. We're live from the Democratic National Convention at the United Center in Chicago and are tracking the 2024 election process.
Who's gonna tell him that the job he's currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs?
Michelle Obama took aim at former President Donald Trump for a statement some have called racist, that illegal immigrants are taking what he called black jobs. The former first lady delivered a rousing speech to the DNC with a simple message: hope is making a comeback. Former President Barack Obama built on the joyful, hopeful tone. He said America should turn away from the politics of hate and anger and toward what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. Obama called the Democratic nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris, someone who spent her life trying to give people the same chances she got.
We need a president who actually cares about the millions of people all across this country who wake up every single day to do the essential, often thankless work.
The crowd repeatedly interrupted former President Obama with chants of "Yes, she can," a riff on his old campaign slogan. Both Obamas warned the race will come down to a handful of votes in contested battlegrounds. That includes Georgia. That state had a surprise celebrity appearance during the night's boisterous nomination roll call. Rapper Lil Jon adapted his hit "Turn Down for What" to reference turnout. Internet influencer Jack Schlossberg, the grandson of former President John F. Kennedy, compared Harris to his late grandfather, quoting a JFK line about putting a man on the moon.
Like President Kennedy, Vice President Harris has dedicated her life to public service. She believes in America, like my grandfather did, that we do things not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
For the first time, the convention granted credentials to influencers, and the campaign has announced it's rolling out targeted social media efforts. That includes a new bilingual WhatsApp channel, hoping to reach younger Latino voters where they spend their time. Tucson Mayor Regina Romero says it can help in Arizona.
tenemos que llevar esta energía.
She says we need to take this energy back to Arizona and ensure that we do the work to give voters information, especially Latinos and younger voters, to get out and vote. Delegates from Chicago's neighbor Indiana say reproductive rights are a key issue there. Allen County Party Chair Derek Camp says Harris was already campaigning effectively on it, even before becoming the nominee.
Certainly something that Donald Trump has made clear that he's going to remove, and so that is definitely something that is going to be top of mind in India.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. We'll be back tomorrow for day three of the DNC. Find our trusted indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Native delegates to the Democratic National Convention are focused on turnout in the tight race for the White House. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native Americans at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago are focusing in on how to get Native voters to the polls in November. National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez is at the DNC and has more.
Tribal leaders and Native vote organizers say they're working to protect Native voting rights and are reaching out to people in their tribal communities, encouraging them to vote. Governor of the Gila River Indian Community, Stephen Rolua, says he's an advocate for his people. At the convention this week, the leader was seen holding his cell phone and sending a video message out on social media to his community.
That's going back home. That's going back to the Gila River Indian community and hopefully all of the 22 tribes in Arizona. As we know, the Native vote is going to be critical, especially in Arizona, the battleground state as well.
After listening to a panel on the Native vote 2024, Gina Katkak, chairwoman of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, says she sees the value in talking to community members about voting.
To make sure that we get them to the polls, looking at that younger generation, the 18 to 24 year olds, having them engaged and participating, just really encouraging that message to get out and vote and to make sure that our voices are being heard.
Debbie Nez-Manuel, Arizona DNC committeewoman, says it's helpful attending the convention, where she's hearing and learning about Native vote efforts across the country and in her state.
This morning we heard from the Arizona Political Network that Montana produced over 60,000 voters, and that was really powerful.
Executive Director of the Native Organizers Alliance, Judith LeBlanc, says her group's efforts are on the grassroots level.
We've been organizing since dirt. We know how to organize. We do know what the problems are. So what we need is the opportunity to voice those during the election, because guess what? On election day, that's a snapshot of the organized power of our communities.
LeBlanc says the Native vote contributes to building healthy and safe tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Rapid City-based clinic is reopening its doors after not seeing patients for nearly a year and a half. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more on the Native Women's Health Clinic.
The clinic hadn't seen patients since April of 2023. A report from last year pointed to staffing issues leading to a large drop in appointments starting in 2021. Clinic officials say it offers OBGYN services, prenatal care, and STI testing. It will still refer deliveries to Monument Health. The clinic has hired a midwife and registered nurse. Clinic director Waisha Whiteface says patients should schedule appointments immediately.
And as fast as you can, because we announced last week that we were opening up for this week, and we filled up within 2 days. The service is very needed here, especially to our Native American women in the community.
The services are limited to enrolled Oglala Sioux tribal members. The clinic was funded through an agreement with OST, Rosebud, and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes. Earlier this year, Rosebud and Cheyenne River pulled their funding, citing concerns the clinic had not seen patients for over a year. Enrolled Rosebud and Cheyenne River members now go to Oyate Health Clinic for women's health services. Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out, says it's unfortunate the other tribes pulled out. He says OST found resources to reopen Native Women's Health Clinic.
And I'm glad it's finally happening. It's great. This is going to be huge, I believe, in the future because of the need. I'm looking forward to seeing that in the future for our membership.
Starr comes out, says he's confident the clinic will remain open beyond his administration. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
And I'm Brian Bull, hosting from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
You
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots reporters about the three-part article on the Portland crime ripple. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy and windy with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 71. Today in history, in 2017, a solar eclipse traversed the continental United States, providing great views in Oregon. The quote of the day is from American jazz pianist Count Basie, who was born on this day in 1904. He said, quote, "Learn to deal with the valleys, and the hills will take care of themselves."
The latest data show the nation's meatpacking industry continues to employ underage workers in some of America's most dangerous occupations. A rights group says not only are the conditions dangerous for the employees, but are also inhumane for the animals being killed in the processing plants. Mark Moran has more.
A U.S. Department of Labor investigation this spring found the number of minors employed in livestock slaughterhouses nearly quadrupled between 2015 and 2022. An animal rights group says the conditions in these plants are dangerous for workers and inhumane for the animals killed there. Iowa slaughters more pigs than any other state. Sean Thomas with the group Animal Equality says there have been cutbacks in the number of inspectors at pork processing plants, where more than 1,000 hogs are slaughtered in an hour, meaning workers are at greater risk and the hogs face inhumane conditions.
To think that even one inspector could verify the safety and the health of the product that was produced and also the humane treatment of any animal entering a slaughterhouse is kind of ridiculous.
Livestock producers say they're constantly looking for more environmentally friendly ways to keep up with consumer demand. They offer as evidence federally funded programs they use to reduce the impacts of large livestock operations. Thomas argues that increased consumer demand and the commercialization of livestock production means producers are moving the industry in the wrong direction.
We're heading not towards a system that would improve the welfare of animals, but we're heading towards a system that will completely disregard it.
Processing facilities reportedly have an effect on their communities, too. A university study has shown a correlation between domestic and sexual violence in places that are home to meatpacking facilities, a link that doesn't exist in manufacturing sectors that don't involve killing animals. This story is based on original reporting by Seth Milstein at Sentient. This is Mark Moran for Iowa News Service.
Three more Willamette Valley counties have found the invasive emerald ash borer beetle threatening their trees. It's notable that the beetles were found far from the previously known infestations in Washington County. Marion, Yamhill, and Clackamas counties have found the beetle, which can seriously damage ash trees. Land managers have removed dozens of infested trees, and they've treated nearby healthy trees with a pesticide to protect against the beetle. They've also hung sticky purple traps on the trees on the tree trunks to help track the bugs. They found beetles in the glue trap in July. Emerald ash borers have been making their way across the U.S. for years, typically decimating local ash tree populations. The first beetle was detected in Oregon in 2022. KBOO's Althea Billings first reported on the danger of emerald ash borers in 2023.
The emerald ash borer. It's a green, wood-boring beetle that is responsible for the destruction of tens of millions of ash trees in North America. In June 2022, the beetle was found in Forest Grove, Oregon. That was the furthest west in the continental United States that it's been seen. Michael Spalding is the district manager in Portland at the Davy Tree Expert Company. He explains.
The emerald ash borer gets its name because it's a bright green metallic color. It's an invasive beetle that's killed hundreds of millions of trees all over the U.S., Midwest, East Coast, Southeast, all the way up to Denver. And now it's just crossed the Rockies and it's here. It decimates these trees typically from the top down, but typically on the warmer side, so you'll probably find signs of the emerald ash borer on the south-facing side of the tree in the canopy. And you'll see thinning and decline fairly rapidly. And these pests move much faster than a bronze birch borer that we've had here for quite a while. They move very fast. And the way that they take apart the tree from the inside, they make them very brittle, very dangerous, and hard to remove once it's, about a 30% canopy dieback. And they're very, very fast and invasive.
Dr. Barry Lyons is a research scientist at the Great Lakes Forestry Center. He explained to Natural Resources Canada how the emerald ash borer kills ash trees.
The eggs laid on the trunk of the tree under a bark chip or in a bark crevice. The tiny larva, when it emerges from that egg, chews its way down through the bark to the surface of the wood. So it occurs in that interface between the wood and the bark, and the larva starts to form a gallery there. Well, that tissue in that area is very important for transporting nutrients up and down the tree and transporting water up the tree. And so as the larva feed, they damage some of those vessels that transport the fluids, and that eventually girdles the tree and causes the death of the tree.
There are signs that an ash tree has been infested with the emerald ash borer. Experts point to a thinning crown of the tree, long shoots growing from the trunk or branches, small D-shaped holes in the bark where the beetles emerge from, and S-shaped holes under the bark that are filled with a fine sawdust. All of these are signs that the emerald ash borer is impacting the tree. Spalding says the emerald ash borer has decimated tree populations east of the Rocky Mountains, and arborists don't yet know how the native Oregon ash will fare against this threat.
We are going to find out how susceptible the native Oregon ash is. Those are planted all over. A lot of the green ash trees are typically planted as street trees and in planters and in like parking lots. You find those quite a lot on the street. So I lived in Chicago for 3 years during the hard thick of the ash pandemic when this was going on as a consulting arborist, and it was really hard to convey the importance of treating the trees prior to them being infested. And after it got about a 20% canopy dieback, it's not worth treating anymore and should be removed. There was a lot of money spent with municipalities. There was a lot of heartache with prized trees in people's properties that had to be removed. It decimates every ash tree in the area.
The emerald ash borer is native to northeastern Asia, and ash trees there co-evolved with the beetle to have stronger defenses. Scientists believe the beetle was brought to North America around 2002 in wood packaging from Asia. Climate change has also made these emerald ash borer infestations worse. Spalding explains.
Climate change stresses out the trees with our longer, hotter, drier summers. And with a stressed tree, you have a weakened immune system, just like a human being. It's more difficult for the tree to fight off the pests. And you also see multiple seasons of these pests. So instead of having one generational cycle, you'll have three or four generational cycles because of a longer, hotter, drier, livable season for them.
People can act now to protect local ash trees from the emerald ash borer beetle, Spalding says. But it's important not to wait until the beetle has already started in on the tree.
Well, the most important thing you can do is keep the health of the tree boosted. So you need to be doing deep root treatments and bringing nutrients to the tree, as well as you have to be treating the tree with an insecticide, an internal insecticide that's targeted for the emerald ash borer. It's a probe about 8 inches long, and you step it down, and it's a high-pressure injection that goes in deep into the soil, all around the root flares, the soil profile, all beneath the canopy of the tree. And if they're not treated, it's almost a guarantee that if the tree's not treated, it will be taken out.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael doesn't join or follow crowds.
I don't care whose pep rally it is, Democrats, Republicans, high school football, they're all sales pitch, puppetry, us versus them. Maybe some truth spoken at Bohemian Grove or Mar-a-Lago, but we're not invited there. We're the maids and waiters, the parking valets. Nor do I want to join the 30,000 at a stadium for some 30-year-old bands, or be part of 70,000 in the desert with 100-degree sandstorms. As if this August is taking pity on us, warm enough for minimal clothing, but not too hot, while we bask in rivers and woods with a couple friends or a couple dozen, high on all the flowers, oxygen, and potential, the fresh fruit and veggies, some that we grew ourselves. The living's no easier in summertime, but seems that way. Winter is coming. Elections and their aftermaths are coming. Poverty, war, unfairness, and avarice never go away. We just don't have to think of them every waking minute. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 21st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Alex Gonzalez, Brian Bull, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Mark Moran. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, and Jeremiah Hayden, reporter